What's going on, everyone, and welcome back to Double M Live Season 6. You heard that, boy? Season 6, man. 6 years in the game. Mike Nice, what's up?
6 in the morning. Yeah, Season 6. Wow. It's been a long time.
Season 6 rings.
Six rings, and you know that's a special one. You see it up here. You see it right there. Six rings is something special. So if that's what type of time we are on here with Double M, you know the season's going to bring you something special as long as we're here rocking.
Yeah, bro. I'm excited for this year. I feel like 2023, well, the last season, we had a lot going on. We did some Double M on the roads and such like that. Now, this year is just about expanding, bro. Expanding, talking to more people, getting to know others, still getting in our sports bag, but, you know, getting into other things as well. And we got a shout out to the team. Shout out to Sam. Shout out to Tex, Mello. You know, we're just expanding as we go. So I'm really excited for Season 6, man.
Growth. That's what it's all about here. Growth, expansion, evolution. That's what we're going to bring to the table. Like you said, you know, still being our sports bag, but we're doing different things here and there. And if you continue to rock with us, you've seen the different things we've dipped our hands into. But Double M, you know, we're not just limited. We're not just in a box. We're going to expand and grow and transform and whatever else comes along our way. You know, we're going to see what we could do that's beneficial for the Double M brand. But also, you know, we want to bring good content to the people. That's important to us. Bring good content to the people. So, yeah, Season 6, I'm excited.
Yeah, and we're not – and to be honest, guys, you guys are here for Double M, of course. But today, you're not going to hear much of us. This isn't about us tonight, man. We have a really, really special guest, Mike Nice. Man, what we got for the people today, bro?
We have somebody who I've been looking forward to getting on this show, this platform for a long time, big in the sports world, you know, great interview loading up. I can't wait for y'all to hear it. I can't wait for, you know, it to get out to the public. We got a special one here on Double M. So without further ado, Mark.
I thought you was going to give them a sneak. You're not going to tell them who it is?
I ain't going to tell them nothing. They just gotta keep tuning in and see what's coming up because it's gonna be a doozy.
It's gonna say it in the title, bro. They're gonna know who it is.
Oh, well, that being said, we gonna have another special guest, Mr. Gary Washburn, joining Double M, and he's gonna give us a hell of an interview. So yeah,
it's special, man. You guys are really gonna enjoy this. What's going on, everyone, and welcome back to Double M Live. And I know you guys see it. There's three screens right now in front of you. Of course, you got Mr. Mike Nice. Mike, what's going on, brother?
Always a pleasure. Good to see everybody, per usual.
And, you know, we're starting off Season 6 with a bang. You know, this is our 6th year doing Double M. We couldn't just do no, you know, little intro or something like that. We have to make sure we come in with a powerhouse. Mike Nice, can you introduce our special, special guest this evening?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Like Marv said, this is a big one, and Season 6 is starting off with a bang. We have here a Boston Globe, national NBA, and Celtics writer and reporter. A man that Marv and I definitely can speak for Marv. We've been following for a long time with a lot of the work that he's put out, a lot of the content that he's put out. We have none other than the great Gary Washburn here with us on Double M. Gary Washburn, welcome to the show.
It's really great to be here, guys. Cool to see you guys doing your thing. And I'm surprised it took so long. 6 years is a long time. I wish I could have been on earlier, but we have to make this more of a regular thing going forward.
Yeah, we've been scratching and clawing a little bit, making our ways and trying to work our way up the ranks. And, you know, thanks to connections and networking, we're in a good place now to make this interview happen. So we're happy to have you here for sure.
For sure, man. Great to be here. And I'm ready. You know, the season's coming up. Media days in a week. And, so, and the season starts in about 5 weeks. So it's going to be another fun ride.
So it's been a busy, I know it's been a busy offseason for you, obviously coming off of the championship year. And we're going to get to that. But we, Mike and I, want to go a little further back and understand, you know, where, how did you get to this position where you are now covering Celtics and you are covering other sports and beyond? Was journalism something that you've always wanted to do?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. I grew up a Lakers fan. Yeah, I grew up like 5 minutes from the Forum.
Okay.
Where the Lakers used to play before they moved to the Staples Center, and now what is it, crypto.com. So I grew up Showtime, Magic, Kareem, you know, those were my teams. So yeah, I was obviously much older than you guys, but I was not a, you know, 84 wasn't a good year for me, and watching Bird and you know, Max and all those guys go at the Lakers. I was always, you know, nervous times because of those are great rivalries. And that's where I, you know, kind of got my basketball chops. I knew that I wanted to be, obviously, like athletically, I messed around and played basketball. I wasn't a great player or anything. You know, I knew I wasn't going to play in college or the NBA or anything like that. But I loved the game. And I knew that I wanted to do something in the media. And when I was coming up, now, like with ESPN and Fox, all these networks, there's correspondence and all that. You know, you can see yourself on television a lot, right? You know, another young Black person seeing, you can see young Black people or Black people on the air and be like, I want to be like that. It wasn't as much like that when I was coming up. There was one person who was used to report from the field on NFL games. His name was Brian Gumbel. And he was a light-skinned dude with a fro. Yeah, before the Today Show and all that. Now he's a little older and does, I know he did Real Sports HBO.
Yep.
But he was younger. He did the NFL game. So they were like, okay, let's go out to the field before the Steelers play the Oilers or the Steelers play the Dolphins or whatever. And we got Brian Gumbel, and he was like on the field doing a report, you know? And I was like, man, that's what I want to do. I want to be like, I want to be on the scene reporting. So, and I was like in middle school or whatever then, probably younger than that, probably like 8-9 years old.
So you knew early.
Yeah, when I knew, I was like, okay, that's what I want to do. And then I wanted to be like a sports announcer. I wanted to be like Sean Grandy or Mike Gorman. And, you know, I wanted to like announce the games too. But when I was growing up, there wasn't a whole lot of like programs for like Black folks and young in my hood for like journalism or whatever. There wasn't a whole lot of things I could do to sharpen my skills, or, you know, when, like, you know, I mean, you know, like growing up, it was like, are you getting good grades? Yeah. Okay, cool. Your mama left you alone. Right. You know, you just did your thing. Don't stay out of trouble. Don't get no girl pregnant. Don't smoke no weed. And I'm gonna leave you alone, and you can watch TV. You know, but that was parenting back then, right? You know, like your mama put food on the table, put a roof over your head, and as long as you didn't get, you know, don't make me come down there to school, you know, your school for some trouble and have to take off day off work and all that. That was parenting, right? It wasn't a lot of, we're gonna put you in, you know, you hear, you know, we're gonna put you in soccer and gymnastics and karate. It wasn't a lot like that. So I kind of had to, you know, carve my own path. I wrote for the school newspaper one semester, my last semester, my senior year of high school. And then when I got to, I attended college at UC Berkeley, and Berkeley had, my junior year, I had, you know, like just kind of my first 2 years in school, I was like, you know, average in terms of like just my grades. I was just trying to make it. And I finally got into my major, which was MASS communications. And I was like, okay, I want to do something now instead of working at the cafeteria, working at the library. Even though the library back then was making like you could make $8 an hour. And back then, I know that sounds really funny. That's nothing. Wow. Like when the minimum wage was like $4 and they was paying $8, you was like, oh, hell yeah, I'm going to get a job at the library,
balling.
So, yeah, exactly, balling. So a lot of my friends got the job at the library, but I was like, okay, I need to do something for my, I need to do something that, that I can, you know, put on my resume. Like working in the library ain't going to do nothing for my resume. So I ended up going to the campus radio station and the campus newsletter. The campus radio station was like, hey, you know, you can come on, you can, you know, you can get, you know, have your own little show, you can do that. Like they broke it down. I was like, you know, great. And then they said, but we don't pay, everything's free. And I was like, you know, because you just probably put in your resume. So when I went to the newspaper, they were like, oh yeah, you know, you could write, you know, cover sports at Berkeley, the Berkeley sports program, you know, whatever particular sports. And, you know, we pay $25 a story. Oh, okay. And then if you help put the paper to bed at night, which means you edit the paper, you read all the stories and put the headlines on and all that. Mm-hmm. Now you can do that in remote. But back then you had to be in the office and literally they would take a little knife and like, okay, this story's two lines too long. You have to cut it. Like, or someone would cut it for you. Like, okay, take that out. Right. That type of thing. And it's like, we pay 50. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I know what job I'm taking. So mm-hmm. I took a job at the newspaper. And once my first beat was field hockey. And once I like got the feeling of I could write, and I wasn't a great English student. People were like, oh, you had to have all A's in English. Like, nah, I was not that guy. I was like B's maybe in English, B's minus. So I was not like some master of the English language. But once I started to become a sports writer, I was like, okay, I really like this. And then I went to a job fair during my, like later in my junior year. And there was a woman there named Annette John Hall, who worked for years as a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And she was working at San Jose Mercury News, which is near my school. And she, I was like, you know, she might've been maybe 32 at the time. And I was like 20. And she was just like, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a sports writer. But I think, I said, don't I have to like, I got to like cover city council. I got to cover murders. Like, don't I got to do that to work in a newspaper? And she was like, nah, you could just be a sports writer. I said, so all I need to do, like, I could just do sports. Like, I don't have to literally go and do triple murders. I don't have to interview crying mamas and all that. Like, I don't have to do that. And she was like, no, not if you don't want to. And I was like, okay, if I could just do sports writing, this is what I want to do for a living. That's it. She told me that. And that's where it started. I got my first job in Long Beach, California, covering high schools, and then moved to another paper in LA where I worked for 5 years. And there I did high schools and I did a little bit of USC. And then I did the LA Clippers. That was my first pro beat way back in the day. And then it just kind of started from there. And that's what I knew I wanted, what I wanted to do. Like, this was my life. Like, I loved it. I loved being at the games. I was never good enough to play, but I was good enough to write about it, observe it, get to know people. You know, I have a story. People ask me sometimes, I saw Biggie three, like, first of all, for y'all youngsters, Biggie was a real person. Okay. Not a hologram. Like, Biggie and Tupac were real people. Okay.
Well, what story are you about to tell us right now?
Okay. So I saw Biggie 3 weeks before he died. In LA. Okay. I was doing the Clippers. People, this is kind of a cool story. So I was doing the Clippers and my first year, and it was the first time Allen Iverson, he was a rookie with the Sixers. It was his first game in LA. And so if you look at like recent interviews with Iverson, him and Biggie were real cool back then. Like, he was talking about, like, Biggie went to his hotel room, brought him a bunch of weed, they got high, like Iverson's trying to play the next night or whatever. Like, it was close. So Biggie comes to the game, right? And he had just gotten in a car accident. So this is like March 97, like, or February 97, like 3 weeks before he got shot. I don't know if he was stayed in LA all through until he got shot, or he went back to New York or whatever, but he was in LA like 3 weeks before he died. So he comes to the game and you know, people be laughing at me like, I thought Ready to Die was a good album, but I wasn't like, oh my God, that's Biggie. Oh, like, I wasn't really tripping. I was like, that's a cool, you know, he cool. He all right. You know, I wasn't really pressed about it, but it was cool to see him there. He was like 6'3". He had a cane. He had velvet jacket on. He was a big dude, right? So he sits behind the basket and with his bodyguard. And so the bodyguard, all these kids come up because people are like, oh, they hated Biggie in L.A. Like, yep. No, they didn't. Like, yeah. Some people did, but Biggie was loved. So all these kids come around. So his bodyguard's like, halftime. He's going to sign him at halftime. So I'm like sitting courtside, and I'm like, man, ain't no way this dude going to sign all these damn autographs. Ain't no, come on, man. He ain't doing that. So halftime comes, and there's a line that forms because he's sitting right behind one of the baskets that forms all the way up the row, all the way through the concourse of kids, like, jeez, you know, like 7-year-olds, 15-year-olds, like kids, because adults are like, who is this guy or whatever, you know, right. You know, or whatever. So it's a bunch of kids, and lo and behold, that dude signed every autograph. I was like, man, that was, he won me over there. I was like, okay, I'm a Biggie fan. And then Life After Death had hit the streets, and then was going back to Cali, and I'm like, oh, I love that song or whatever. Then he got shot, but he was back behind the locker room waiting for Iverson to come out. It was like, that was people like, you ever see Big? I was like, yep, I did. And 3 weeks later, he got killed.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, I know I went way off topic, but
it's all good. All good.
But yeah, like I did the Clippers, and then I did baseball for 8 years. I covered the Oakland A's for 4 years. I don't know if you guys ever heard of the movie, saw the movie. God, what's it called?
Moneyball.
Yeah, thank Money, you.
Yep.
Getting old.
Yep.
Moneyball. I covered those Moneyball teams.
Oh, okay. That must have been real interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then I covered the Baltimore Orioles for 4 years, and then the Sonics for 3 years. I covered Ray Allen's teams for 2 years, and then he got traded to the Celtics. And then I covered AD his rookie year, playing 6'11", playing shooting guard, you know, just too big for his, too small for his uniform.
Skinny KD.
Skinny KD. Quick. Yeah. You could just see the talent. You were like, oh, God. And he never, you always say, well, when this dude fills out, but he kind of never did. Yeah. But he gained maybe like 25 pounds since then. But yeah, it was fun to see him just like at 19 years old, just be so smooth. You're like, oh man, this dude's gonna.
So did you know right away?
That's exactly what I was about to ask. That's exactly what.
Yeah, you knew. He just had that like motion. He was just fluid. Yeah, like some dudes ain't ready to come to the league. KD was ready to come to the league. He physically got pushed around sometimes because he was so skinny. But that's why PJ Carlissimo was a coach. That's why he played him at shooting guard. Because he wasn't big enough,
banging enough
to cover. Like, you know, small forwards back then was like Mitch Richmond, like real, real strong mofos, right? You know, dudes that would post you up. You know, the NBA is a little bit more physical then. So KD was going to get pushed around if he ever tried to guard forwards. But he put him at the two, and he was a matchup nightmare. Then he could shoot. He was just a natural shooter. He had a flow for the game. He was a good teammate. Like, just to cover him that 1 year when he was just kind of the – you know, before he got all into the Twitter and hearing his all the magic.
He's a different guy now.
It was just the innocent KD. Just it was fun to see him develop, come out. You know, he brought some of his people from DC, and he, you know, just made a home in Seattle. And all of a sudden, you know, that last season in Seattle was kind of miserable because the team was about to move. But just to see him as a 19-year-old was just, it was, man, you just saw it. So then after that, the team left. I actually got laid off because my paper closed down. A few months later, I got a call from a man named Joe Sullivan to do national NBA writer for the Globe in August 2009. And I knew about Boston. I didn't think anything negative of it. I've been here, you know, for like games or whatever. I actually dated someone who was from Lawrence. So
Lawrence, like, great city.
Yeah. So I had some exposure to Boston. I had no idea what it was going to be like, but it was like, you know, let me just jump in and try it. And it's been an amazing experience the last 15 years. It probably couldn't have gone better for me in terms of just moving to a new city. And then Boston, as you guys know, is a hungry city in terms of sports. They love their pro sports, especially. They're into it. It's great to be in a market that really cares about what you write And I get a lot of criticism, which is fine or whatever. The people think I hate the Celtics. I'm too hard on them or whatever. Obviously, my relationship with Missoula, which is
we're gonna get there.
It's better than people think. But just to be in a market that really cares about what you write about, and to see the parade was crazy. Just to see all the people of color, all the different people out there, now all nationalities who love the Celtics, and I think Boston, when you from LA, I have friends, you like it there? Because they watching, you know, YouTube videos or old videos of cold outside in Madison, Boston Garden, and number white people in the stands in the 80s. And then they're like, it's not what it's like. It's not what it's like there. It's very diverse. A lot of beautiful people there, a lot of different nationalities. You know, so it's been a great experience. So, yeah, just sports writing is kind of taking me here. It's been a real dream kind of for me. I couldn't have probably envisioned it going any better.
Thank you for sharing that.
I have so many questions that was flowing through my mind as you were talking. But I definitely want to start with this one. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but I want you to explain. What do you feel is the greatest part of your job? I know you shared about some great experiences that you had, but if someone watching this and listening to this would say, man, what is something that's really great about the job that you have? What is something that really stands out for you with your job?
It's just the games, man. Like I always say, if I ever get tired of going to the games, I'll know it's time to step away, but I still get excited about the game. Just the atmosphere, the popcorn, the fans, the strategy, like that's just great. Just to be in an environment, and now, you know, like people care so much about the game. Sports has become such a, you know, just gigantic part of our culture, right? Where it's just, and people are so interested that it's the game. I'm like, I just sometimes sit, even now, you know, like my wife would be like, oh, you work a lot. I'm like, honey, like I'm watching basketball for a living. I told her that like early in our relationship, she was just like, you go, you're traveling. And I'm like, I'm not digging ditches. I'm not, you know, I'm not laying out like, you know, nothing. I'm not laying out tar and retarring the freeway. I'm literally going to watch basketball games.
Beautiful.
I'm going to the finals or I'm going to All-Star. Like I can't complain. That's the best part, just to be in that atmosphere. You know, that's why, I mean, the culture is like where people, why, you know, people don't want to ever leave in terms of like, you know, former players become broadcasters, they become coaches, because it's just that atmosphere, the competitive atmosphere of seeing teams go at it, you know, seeing guys and teams that you've gotten to know, players you've gotten to know over the years. And it's like their journey towards a championship. And now obviously 24, they got it done, but seeing a lot of those, you guys were there for those, a lot of those teams, and Marcus Smart and Isaiah Thomas and guys that just you rooted for, not like, oh, go get them, Isaiah, but good guys, good people. Yeah. They deserve
representations.
Yeah, they deserve, you know, and to see them and sometimes a disappointment or their journey ending and just the different personalities. I always say, like, being a sports writer or being in this industry, you got to be a people person. And I don't mean you always got to talk people's ears off or you got to hustle people, but you have to get to know people. You have to look at their resume and ask them about things that they're interested in. When you get to know the players, and you got to figure out personalities, like you guys went to high school, you guys went to college. There were certain people that you could come a certain way at and other people you could come a different way at. And that's the same when you get pro athletes. There's some guys you can say anything to and they'll be laughing and they're good. Other people, you got to be careful how you come at them. Like people ask me, how was it to cover Kyrie? And Kyrie was on the ladder. You had to watch what you say to him. He was one of them dudes, like, you couldn't come at him with a sloppy question. You couldn't come at him with a lazy question. One, you had to let him talk. You had to let him preach and go through his thing. And two, you had to figure out how to approach him. And you can't, like, people ask, whoa, you know, is he, like, I had no problem with Kyrie. Like, I actually liked him. Although he was different, one of the most unusual guys that I ever covered, because he's one of those that you can't say you can't assume anything. If you said to him, Christmas, December 25th, he'd be like, who said that? Why you say that? I say the 28th, and he'll try to prove it to you. He might just be messing with you. But like, you assume something, and he'll shut down. If you just throw a general question at him and let him talk, that's the way to go with him. And I think a lot of the media here didn't quite understand how to come at him because he was a man of different personalities.
Sure and was.
I think I gained his respect. We had a healthy respect because I was like, okay, I got to ask a question. It's just general. I can't assume anything. Not even that they lost the game. You know, the only thing you can assume is he's talking to you. And so That's the thing about being a sports writer is just also the great thing is the games and the people you meet. I mean, coming here and meeting Tommy Heinsohn, John Havlicek, Bill Russell.
Legends.
You know, just guys, you know, even I'm cool with Cedric Maxwell, a guy, you know what I'm saying? Just to meet the legends and some of them, you know, have passed on, unfortunately, or interviewing Paul Silas or Bill Walton or just, I mean, that's just priceless. You can't get that. Like, those are the, like, they're your heroes and you get to meet them and you get to talk to them and you're like, wow, like, you know, you just have to have that respect for their greatness. Or, you know, like covering Kobe's first summer league game. And you guys asked me about KD. Wow. And yeah, like seeing that dude basically 18 years old playing with NBA guys. And you can tell, man, you can tell when you guys have seen enough ball to know when some of these dudes ain't ready and some of the dudes are ready when they come out of like now that's one and done, right? Like, we all love Gerald Green, but he probably wasn't ready, but he could get up. I thought
that guy was going to take off to the moon.
Yeah. He had the athleticism. He just, he didn't have the mental and didn't have the physical, you know, and he had made a solid career for himself, but like physically, athletically, he's top five I've ever seen, right? Like, like it didn't catch up until, you know, he probably should have went to school or whatever. But to see Kobe at like 18 years old and how he carried himself, it was like, man, like this dude is different. And I'm not saying, oh, I knew he was going to be a 20-year, you know, with the Lakers and Hall of Fame. I didn't, but I just knew like this dude is different. Mm. And that's the thing of just getting this, watching talent, watching players, getting to know coaches, having conversations, pulling them aside, you know, ask them about their, even when the tape recorder or the phone is off, just ask them about their families and doing your homework, ask them about where they went to school, ask them where they from, you know, just getting to know those, building those relationships is also a great part of the job. It's just kind of like every day is a challenge, you know, and it's a competition. You know, I have competition with other, you know, newspapers and other websites or whatever. So it's like still like playing ball a little bit, but it's a competitive business. So it was a great decision, a great choice, but like, it's just the one thing I would suggest to young is just be a people person. Like, and even though like, I think the one thing that separates young people from older people is like, they don't bond. Young people look at old people like, yeah, you did it, but you can't help me. And older people look at you like, you don't know nothing. So there's this natural disconnect. And you have to like approach older people and you have to like, how I put this, like learn how to bond with them. Like if you're 30 or 28 and you're trying to talk to a coach who's 57, he's old enough to be your father. So how do you build a relationship with him or her knowing that's a father-son kind of thing? But you can't be father-son. I mean, they can give you advice, but there's got to be a friendship and a bond there. So there's got to be a commonality. And as a young person, it's kind of your responsibility if you're trying to get to know that GM to build that commonality for them to respect you. Like, you can't talk about Kendrick Lamar and Drake all the time. Like, they're going to be like, what? You know, you got to talk about things they want to talk about. You got to learn from them as much as they can learn from you. And I think that's some of the difficulty sometimes that young people might have is bonding and trying to form relationships with old. Like, you can't just think because you're old or you old enough to be my daddy, you useless. Like, you can't think that way. You ought to be my mama. Like, what am I learn from you? I can, like, you gotta be able to be variant, versatile in the people that you get to know. And sometimes it takes a lot of listening. Like, you know, if I sat down with Tommy Heinsohn, I ain't doing a lot of talking. God bless him. Right. So, like, I would listen to his stories and let him talk. Or if I hear, you know, like, I got a chance to interview a guy I got close to, was really hurt when he passed, was John Havlicek, because he was so such a gentleman. And you're like, man, this is like Hondo, and I'm talking to him. And you know, and you just let him tell his stories, and you're just like, man, or you let Max, you talk to Max. Let Matt tell the stories of the 84 finals, and you just listen, and you just sit there like, damn, you know, or you might joke with him, ask him questions or whatever, but it's like, that's how you kind of form those bonds. And I think, you know, it's all about doing the video work, all about doing a podcast, and all about doing, you know, having the wild, crazy opinions you want to have them. But it's also about building relationships to where you can go to people and as guests, and people respect you and go, yeah, you know, you do your homework. You know, that's the thing, doing the homework, doing your research. Google, don't ask somebody something that you can find right out of, where'd you go to college? Like, you can look that up, man. Like, you know, things, you know, like, it takes homework. It takes more than just having sports opinions, right? Everybody has sports opinions. Everybody want to be Stephen A. People don't know Stephen A was a sports writer for 25, 30 years before he became Stephen A, right? Mm-hmm. People think he just, all of a sudden, ESPN hired him out of college. Like, yeah, we just want you to give us all your sports opinions and be real loud about it. You know, it's like, no, he didn't do that right out of college. He covered the league, covered the Sixers, was a columnist. He paid his dues, and now, obviously, he's an entity. So I just think the people relationships, going back to your question, and the games is still what I really love.
Gems, dropping gems. And you could tell, Gary, that you have a real passion and love for your job. It's just amazing to hear everything you have to say. Go ahead, Marv. I know you had something loaded up.
Yeah, no, just hearing the fire in your voice about the love that you have for it is definitely it's inspirational. I want to stick to the city of Boston for a second here. It's because you brought it up a little bit. It's funny, when I leave Massachusetts and you tell people you're from Boston, like, there's black people in Boston, but no one ever knows that there's black people in Boston. It surprises me all the time. And you coming from the West Coast and going into Boston, Mike and I, we very similar. We had a college radio show as well, and we killed it. We had a great time doing that college radio. We held it down. But one of the biggest reasons why we did it is because growing up in Boston, listening to Boston media, the representation just wasn't there. Just listened. We always had to listen to pretty much media bashing players that looked like us. And that's what everyone would have to believe, because that's all everyone had to hear. So Mike and I were like, all right, we got to, you know, try to put in a different younger perspective, and two, speak on where we think players are coming from. When you came in here in 2009, did you see that? And how did you feel about it? And did you feel like you were you had a responsibility? Maybe you didn't. Well, did you feel like you had a responsibility as a black man to try to put in a different perspective in the city?
Yeah, I think one, there's a difference between what I do as a writer and a columnist, and then like a talking head on a radio station. Mm-hmm. Who, the one thing that I wish those guys did more was go into the locker room and talk to the players, as opposed to sitting at home watching the game and then going on from 10 to 2 or 2 to 6 and just throwing out their opinions, because you, at that status, you have credentials, right? You can get into the game. It's not like, let's say, you know, I'm sure if the Celtics gave you guys credentials, you come to the games and you talk to guys, but they have the power and the resources to be able to come to the arenas and come to the field, Gillette or Fenway or TD Garden or whatever, and get perspectives and talk to people. And then they would have more informed opinions. That's what happened. That's what doesn't happen in a lot of sports talk radio. A lot of it's sensational. And I don't really connect with that. My job is to cover the Celtics the best I can and give a fair and accurate story. It's not my job. And I tell, like, it's not my job to be a fan. Like, I'm not a fan. And as much as you get to know these guys and you bond with them, and so when they won a few months ago, it was good to see Jalen and Jason and the monkey off their back, and just to and Al Horford. I mean, you can't not say, man, I'm not, you know, yeah, I'm happy for Al. Like, yeah, it's amazing. 17 years, he won a chip, and he was a contributing. He wasn't just at the end of the bench. He wasn't riding. Wasn't like he was just there. He literally contributed to a championship team. Or you look at Derek White, you know, of course you feel good for those guys. But my job as a reporter is to tell it like it is. If they play well, say it. If they don't, say that too. And I think the thing about it is, and also give a Black perspective in terms of somebody telling some of the stories and explaining some of the ways that these guys, their stories might not be told, like a Jaylen Brown, right? Trying to create, kind of erase the wealth disparity in Boston when he signs his contract, things like that, that maybe others would not understand. I just think that, unfortunately, with talk radio now, a lot of those guys don't do their research. They don't come to the game. They don't talk to the athletes. So they just fire away. And sometimes we get, you know, what do they call it? We get strays because the athletes hear what they said on the radio, and they're like, oh, y'all, not me. I didn't say that. You know, but we all get gathered into the media. So that's right. The thing about talk shows and having, and yeah, like, you guys are, I mean, they all look like the same people. There's all the same opinions, all the same, not all the same opinions, but just all, you know, it's all the same things. Two white hosts, white guy, white guy who runs the, you know, updates, and it's just the same thing. And the unfortunate thing about Boston is I think we're kind of used to that.
Yeah.
So change is really hard, you know, because everybody hires who they're comfortable with. You know, we have to have some diverse voices. I know there's a couple of brothers who are trying to get into that, you know, Cerrone Battle, Leroy Irvin. I see some of those guys trying to do their thing on the radio, and I hope that they can, you know, get an opportunity if they're to get, you know, promoted on their merit, because those guys know their games, and hopefully they can move up. But I don't as much relate to, you know, talk show hosts, talk radio, because they're not at the arena with me. We're not talking. They're not in the locker room talking to those guys. They're not talking to Missoula. If Missoula's on their show, they'll talk to them, of course, right? But that's the team setting that up. But they're not out there putting in the work, grinding in the field, like, hey, let me go talk to Jacoby Brissett. Let me go talk to Jerod Mayo. Let me go talk to Joe Missoula. One-on-one or after a practice, let me go talk to, like, you know, I wish that they would do more of that and be more informed as opposed to just throwing stuff out there.
Yeah, I definitely got to agree with you in the sense that, you know, like you said, usually the talk show hosts and what, they're not in the field doing the work and getting to know and have building those relationships. And another thing you said that I feel is really true, you know, Boston and the city, they're just really comfortable with, you know, the content they're getting when it comes from radio and these hosts. Yeah. And it's something that they're used to year after year. You know, it's just the environment they're used to. And I think something that Marvin and I we've always had in our minds is, you know, if we got a chance to just inject a different kind of life or a different kind of voice into, you know, sports media in Boston a little bit when it comes to, you know, radio and whatnot, you know, like we've just been saying, there's not only white people in Boston, you know, it's very diverse. You said that when you were talking a lot earlier, you know, it's very diverse here when you really get to see the people here and really, you know, get intertwined in the environment. So, you know, that's something that I know Marvin and I think about all the time.
I'm saying this,
but I have
this real quick. You know, if you're young and you're a person of color, you know, you just have to be, I just don't think people have any idea, people of color, that they can do what I do, or they can do what you guys do. Like, I don't think that they follow it enough to know. They just think that somehow I got lucky, you know, and it was from hard work. But if you want to be an intern, you want to, you know, I get people, oh, I want to be your assistant and follow you around. Like, you know, like, maybe not, like, I can't just bring you around. But if you want a job shadow, or you want to do things that are like, that's how others get in, right? Being an intern, being working part-time, or asking if they could do stuff for free, or like you guys, creating your own media. You know, that's how you have to and then you, then someone will look at you and be like, oh, or somebody might ask me, hey, you know some guys, and I'll be bitching, you know, like, that's how things go. I think a lot of us as younger people, we don't, with the media, we just think it's all like, oh, that's just them. It's white folks doing that. Like, I can't do that. Or they have no idea. They don't ask me, well, how did you get, like you did? How did you get? And it wasn't, I wasn't a straight A student. I wasn't a master in English. It's just, I just kind of knocked on some doors and got some breaks. And that's how we have to do it. And I just think, unfortunately, when I see, like, I'm at the arena and I see young people trying to get on, they're mostly they don't look like us at all, you know. And I'll help anybody who will ask me for my help, but I would love to see more young people of color and more young women want to get and just say, hey, can I come to a game or whatever? And, you know, I'll, you know, if it's not me, someone like, I'll, you know, we'll work on that. You know, there's got to be, there's ways, and you got to, but it's a hustle. Like, you know, yep. Not in a good way, not a bad, good hustle, where you have to make a call, you have to send an email, you know, or if the person doesn't return your email, you can't take it. Oh, you just ghosted me. Oh, hell no. You got to send another one.
Yeah,
right. Man. And you got to send the third. And the person might be like, oh, shoot, I got 1400 emails I ain't looked at. That's why I ain't returned, because I don't, like, you know, some people got, like, you know, I got 3,000 emails I haven't looked at. Like, damn, really? Like, people do that. I asked my wife, oh, I got 173 emails today from work. Like, did you read all of them? Hell no, I didn't read all of them. Like, it's like, that's sometimes how it goes. It's not to be taken personal. Sometimes people are just, like, kind of inundated with stuff, right? But I just think we need to be more aggressive. And if you don't know how, ask how. Don't assume that, oh, that's for just them, or I got to go to a special school. No. Would it help that you were in college? It would help to go to college and do this. Yes. Would it help to know the right people, or would it help to get training? Yeah. But what I tell young people too is that you guys have so many ways now. Like, I wasn't going to be there. If I was like trying to start my own media when I was like, I would have had to like print some stuff on a copy and print a whole newspaper like that. You know, y'all got all these, you know, YouTube, all these tools, this microphones from, you know, Amazon, like, you got all the ways to create your own media, to create your own voice, your blog, your stories, all that video, phone, like, all that is right at your disposal. And like, use that. And even though, and you never know, like with you guys, you know, it's like, I'll be on anybody's show, but it's like, I see you guys, of course I'm gonna be on your show. And there's a lot of people who feel that way. Like, yeah, I'll be on your pod. You might score a player. You might score somebody who's like, yeah. As long as you don't, like, you know, as long as they know 3 hours, or not necessarily, not right. Saying for me, but it's like, you know, don't take all my time or be on time or whatever. Right. You know, like, as long as you never know who might help you, because people want to help. Especially people who have been where you guys have been want to help. Not you guys, but just young people. And I just think when I go to the arena and I see young people trying to get on, they don't look like us. And I wish I knew a way and, you know, to like, you know, help to be like, hey, you can job shadow me. You know, this is what you need to wear. Okay. This is what you need to do. And don't run and take pictures of Jason Taylor's new sneaks and all that. No, don't do that. Like, you know, just, I'll guide you or whatever. And I just think that's how we get more younger people involved, that a lot of young people don't know that they can do what you do. They can do what I do. They can create their own media or get into the media. They think they got to be, well, I gotta be straight A student. Or I gotta go to like BU or BC. No, you know, whatever college, you know, you can make a success if you work hard enough wherever you go.
Thank you for that. I don't know if this is a podcast for the people or a podcast for us, Mike. I'm telling you, notes, bro.
The mental notes loading up in my head right now. So, Marv, I don't know, but I need to ask this question. I know we want to get into some basketball talk a little bit, but I got to ask this question because, like I said earlier in the show, obviously been reading your work for a lot of years now, right. And it's obviously inspirational because, you know, Marv writes, I write a little bit, like it's something that's a part of us. I just want to ask you a little bit about your craft. You know, you said you're not a wordsmith, or, you know, you said English wasn't your best thing and whatnot. But like when you sit down and write the masterpieces that you put out, what goes into your thought process of, you know, getting the story out? I know you said you simply, you know, write if a player is playing good, write if they're playing bad. Like you have some opinions and some of the things you write and whatnot. What's your thought process when putting out written content for the masses to read?
Well, what I want to do, my plan is to write something that no one else is going to write. And sometimes that means just observing the game and looking at little things that happen in the game, whether it be like a dude on the bench slapping his seat because he's upset, or a conversation like earlier this year, I think Buddy Hield was playing for the Pacers and he was taking shots after timeouts at the Celtics basket, and like Sam Cassell ran out to try to stop him from doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm the only one that saw that. And I asked Cassell about that. Like, I want to get in some little nugget that nobody else has. And sometimes it's hard to do that because everybody sees everything. And other times you just have to be observant. And that's what I want to do. I want the reader to know something about the game that they are not going to read anywhere else, whether it be a quote from someone who might not be quoted very often. Or I remember like when Kyrie's rookie year and his dad was sitting courtside and he had the game-winning bucket to beat the Celtics. You know, this is before LeBron came. This is early young Kyrie. And I went out there and talked to his father, who played at BU, about watching his son kind of cook the Celtics as a 19-year-old. And like, that's a perspective. Or when Jason Tatum won his first gold medal in Japan, I called his father when I was in Tokyo to talk, get his reaction to watching his son win gold. Like, you try to take angles, and sometimes it's just extra work or just chasing somebody down. And sometimes, and when you're writing, sometimes the words just come into your head and you just write, and there's like a voice and it's just telling you what to write. Now, that voice is not always right. Sometimes you need to read over what your voice tells you, but you have to figure out what kind of angle do I want to take when I write about a game. Whether you're writing a game story where you're describing to the readers what happened, or you're writing a column where you're trying to give your opinion on what happened in the game. And you just have to kind of figure out, okay, what's going to be my angle? And sometimes it's unfortunately what everybody else is, because it's just so obvious. If Jason Tatum scores 60 points, what I did was I tried to ask him about his relationship with his dad. Like, I tried to do something a little different.
Okay.
Although everybody's going to write about Jason Tatum scoring 60 points, I say to myself, how can I write differently that no one else will cover? Sometimes another reporter talks to the same person and it doesn't work. You end up writing, they work just as hard, sometimes even harder, or they get somebody, and you're like, damn, they got him too. Okay, whatever. I got to just take the tie on this one. But it's just kind of figuring out your approach and knowing your strengths and weaknesses, not using words you don't know, right? You don't have to be Shakespeare. Don't use a bunch of words. Don't try to be too fancy if that's not your normal language. Now, you can use words, like there's certain words I like to use. I like to use the word putrid. I don't know why. I've used that word for years, which means rotten, stink, like you were terrible, porous, like things like that. There's certain words I like to use, sparkling. But know what those words mean, right? Don't try to overwrite. Don't try to the more simplistic. If that's your thing, like I'm just gonna stick. Like, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Hitch with Will Smith.
Yes.
And he was telling dude how to dance, and he was just like, this is you.
And he started.
Don't try started nothing
doing,
else.
Yeah, he started doing too much.
And he started doing the snake. Oh, this is you. That's when you start writing and learn how to write, this is you. Then you start taking maybe a chance here and there. And sometimes you miss, but as long as you're correct, your information is correct, as long as you don't use no crazy words, you don't know the meaning. If you think you know the meaning of a word, look, and you're not quite sure, you got Google, look it up, right? You ain't got like the old days, you got to pull out a dictionary, look it up online. What does that word mean? Because sometimes you think a word means something because in the English language, we get used to using the same words. And it's not quite what you're trying to say. So if you're clear in what you're trying to say and you write concisely and you have an idea, and the more games you see, the more ideas you'll see, and the more you'll observe. Like the more games you see, the more you'll observe what happens between Missoula and the officials, or how a guy, like there was one time where it was when they lost, I forgot, was it? It might have been game 7 against Miami in 23 when they lost at home. And Jason Tatum was so despondent, he walked off the floor with a towel over his on his neck. And some fan just reached out and grabbed the towel. And I was like, damn. And he just kept walking.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, like, dude's coming off the floor. Why would you reach out and grab his towel like that? Like, you really going Jason's sweaty towel? Like, that's going to really, you know, what you going to do with that? Like, even if you try to sell it, no one's going to believe, this came off Jason Tatum's body. Oh,
who going to believe you?
Yeah, who going to believe you? So you got a sweaty towel from a dude who just lost game 7 after trying to come back from a 3-0 lead. And so the fact that he didn't flinch when the dude pulled the towel off his neck, I just wrote about how this, that's how despondent he was. He just kept walking. And like, to me, those little things are like, cool to write about. Like, people like that type of stuff. People like when you write about certain scenes as opposed to getting all these fancy pretty words. Tell me what happened, or give me a scene. You know, when he was 8 years old, you know, Jaylen Brown used to, you know, do this when he was younger to get to work on his shooting or things like that. People love that type of stuff. And that's just a matter of just getting just practice, like anything else, like sports. It's just reps.
Yeah.
Right? It's just reps. You're not going to be as good a writer at 23 than you'll be at 33. You're just not. Right. You're going to be better as you get age, just like anything else in life. You're going to be better driver, you're going to be better with the ladies, you're going to be better whatever as you get older and you get more experienced. And so when you're younger, I would say just do what you do. What are you more comfortable with? Are you, because some people when they're young are very good writers, right? And so they rely on that. Other people are good reporters, scene setters. Others are both. If you happen to be both, you're blessed, right? It's like some people can score and play D. Some people can just score and some people just play D. You have to do what your strengths are and then try to work on your weaknesses as you go along. Maybe introducing more words or introducing, you know, if you're looking more for things to write about, if you're like, okay, I'm not the greatest reporter, but I'm a good writer. Okay. So I'm gonna look around more. I'm gonna try to catch some things that I've maybe not caught before. I'm gonna try to be more perceptive. So it just all depends. You have to assess yourself too, and maybe someone else, like what's your strengths. And if you, you know, you, not everybody LeBron, right? Not everybody Kobe, like, that you got weaknesses. You know, there's a player, you know, there's some JaVale McGee's out there, there's some DeAndre Ayton's out there, they're all needed.
Yeah.
So you just have to figure out what you are and then try to improve on what you need to improve on.
Yeah, mental notes just going into my head, man. Wow.
We've taken a lot of your time, Gary, so I do want to transition a little bit into the Celtics here. First of all, the biggest news, obviously outside of the Celtics winning the championship, re-signing everybody in the offseason, I think the biggest news right now in Boston is the ownership drama, if you will, that's going on with Boston. So we saw that as soon as they gave Tatum the bag, they sold it. They're ready to sell the team. And then now news has come out a few days ago that there's been issues between Wick and the father, and that he's the reason why he wanted it to get out, because Wick was overspending. I want to get your perspective on what's happening right now with the team, and why hasn't there been any movement so far with buying the Boston Celtics? Is it due that they don't own their own building, or is there more to it?
Well, first of all, selling a professional sports team can be a very long process. Okay. So I would not expect this to happen in a few months. They're going to be like, if you look at a guy like Steve Pagliuca, the minority governor. He's going to try to gather together a team and gather together capital to make a bid for the team. The NBA is like, yeah, the NBA is just going to observe this. They want to see how much the Celtics cost, because they're one of the most storied franchises in professional sports, one of the most storied franchises in the NBA. Is this going to be a $6 billion price? Mm-hmm. And I just think, to me, if you're going to buy the Celtics, you're going to want to build a new arena. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with TD Garden, but you don't own it.
That's a must. Yeah.
You don't own it. So look at Steve Ballmer bought the Clippers. If you want to look at an example, he bought the Clippers when the whole thing with Donald Sterling went down in 2014. And it took him, now the new arena, the Intuit Dome, is going to open this season. It took him 10 years to build a new arena, right? Now, it might take 10 years, so we might not see a new Celtics arena until 2038 or 40 or whoever, right? It could be a minute, but if you're an owner, arena ownership is where it's at. You get to make the money off the arena, the parking, the concessions, all the other events that happen in your arena 300 something days a year. Look at all the events that happen at Staples Center or Crypto.com, from Beyonce and Usher concerts to the circus, to the WNBA games, hockey games, everything. That's what you want. Like, the Bruins own the arena. So the Celtics, if you're an owner of the Celtics, you probably are not comfortable with that agreement long term. You'll buy into the team and purchase the team, but the back of your mind is like, okay, now let me talk to some people in the city, you know, around the city. Let me talk to some people to find out where I can build a new arena, whether it's going to be where Encore is, whether it's going to be the Seaport. Where can I build a state-of-the-art basketball arena that can, you know, put the TD Garden out of business, or put the TD Garden to shame, or, you know, where can I do that? Or do we combine with the Bruins and combine ownership on a new arena where the Celtics owners make as much money, or how does that go?
Think about that. Well, okay.
Because now, you could have two major arenas. Like, we're looking at Los Angeles has a Staples Center. Now they have the Intuit Dome, and they have SoFi, where the Rams and the Chargers play, but they have two major arenas, and they still have the Forum that can hold, like, you know, if the backup concerts, the folks that ain't gonna fill 25,000, it might fill 10, you know, if it's Boys to Men or something like that, So this Boston will have to decide. And I think the city will participate. Of like, okay, where do we want to go? How do we want to add and upgrade to another new venue? And so I think whoever is considering buying the team is asking themselves that, trying to figure out with the architects and all the city planners about where they could build a new arena, or whether this deal is feasible for them long term to go in with the Bruins. So that's a thing that could take a while. Who would buy the team? You know, could it be Bezos? Could it be a group of people? Could you get some real money people, but then put up, let's say, get Kevin Garnett or Paul Pierce? I'm just throwing it out there. Or Ray Allen, or somebody who's like the front man. Like, if you look at Minnesota, it's A-Rod, who's trying to buy the Timberwolves. Now, A-Rod might have 5% of the money that's going, but he is the front man. So those teams have to be put together. So this is a long process. And I think now if Wick had an owner in mind before this all went down, that'd be something different. Who's like, hey, just I got you. We, you know, we can sell this fast. When I was in Seattle, Howard Schultz, who was the Starbucks guy, put the team up for sale in January 06. The team sold in July. Like 6 months is real fast, but he knew he just sold to the first bidder, which was Clayton Bennett and his group from Oklahoma City, right? They were planning to move the team unless they got a new arena in Seattle. So everybody knew the lease was up in 2010. This was 2006, so 4 years is not that long. And so he sold it to basically the first available bidder. And that was the Oklahoma City people. That's what everybody knew the Sox were about to bounce. But if you're, I don't, you know, obviously the team's going to stay in Boston. There's no, I'm not saying that, but like if Wick had in mind, okay, I know someone that wants to buy the team. If he's had private conversations with a, with an owner and says, yeah, if you ever put it up for sale, I'd be interested. That could be happening right now. Paliuka could be is gathering his team. And I'm sure there's other people who want to own a professional sports franchise, maybe other an NFL owner, a baseball owner, or a hockey owner who might want to delve in and says, hey, I'd like to own a basketball team. You know, Joe Lacob probably would have bought the Celtics years ago if it was for sale, but he ended up buying into the Warriors. So, you know, there's a lot of possibilities here. So I think the fans and folks should just be cool on this. Like, everything's going to be, for the short term, the same. They're not, they're going to sell the team and cut salaries. They're not going to release Tatum off his contract. Nothing like that. Everybody going to get their money. Everybody going to get their paper. It's just long term, how will this affect the franchise? Will you get an owner that wants to spend a lot of money? Will you get an owner that wants to spend a medium amount of money? How does that go? That's the uncertainty of it. And I think when that New York Post story was kind of saying that the father was a little unhappy with how much money Wick was spending on the franchise, but it got him a championship. Now, will that championship reap its benefits financially? How much does a championship cost? It does raise the worth of the franchise for a sale. That's what it does do. But shoot, if you was going off championships, the Dallas Cowboys is a valuable team. They won a Super Bowl. Exactly. So probably I was in diapers, years, if not before you guys were born. So sometimes championships don't mean a whole lot when it comes to value, comes area, the players that you have. You know, it's like the Lakers. The Lakers are, you know, you want to buy the Lakers, good luck with that. You know, the Lakers are worth a lot of money. Same with the Celtics. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past like an owner, a billionaire, who just has kind of been quiet, who might need to be talked into buying a team, or didn't think the Celtics were going to be available, and is doing his legwork or her legwork now.
All right. I think I already know where the new building is going to be. I see it right across from Encore. It's going to make a lot of money. If you set up a new stadium right across Encore, we know what gambling is like right now. It's open up in Massachusetts. I think that right there, boom, magic. Yeah.
Not wrong with that at all. That's a good location. Little bit more basketball talk. Want to dive a little bit more into the team for sure. Like we've listened to, you've covered basketball for a long time. You know and have seen how hard it is for a team to go back to back. And, you know, you've covered the Celtics. We've obviously been watching and been fans of the Celtics. And this team has, coming off of the 24 championship, they kind of knocked out some of the narrative of this team being soft and they don't have what it really takes and the pedigree to get over that championship hump. You know, they shut everybody up. Like Tatum said, what can you say now? But do you really think this team is one of them type of teams that can go out and do it again back-to-back seasons? Are they built with that kind of chemistry, with that kind of culture, with the players that they have? Obviously, one of the most talented teams in starting fives or sticks in the lineup. Do you think this team or this current era of the Celtics can get multiple championships under their belt.
I do think they're capable, but it's going to be, I mean, this is going to be a harder season than last year because one, Porzingis is not going to be back till January. So you're looking at Al Horford, 38 years old, is your starting five. Luke Kornet, Nebius Keita, and Xavier Tillman are that's your bigs. You know, that's not going to, you know, scare a whole lot of teams. Not to say they can't be productive, but Porzingis brings a whole another element. Now, the good news in that is that Porzingis, you get him plenty of rest. You don't bring him back until he's ready. And then he's rested and he only has, let's say, 40 games under his belt before the playoffs, where everybody else has 80. And so he's fresh. And now, and remember, they won most of their playoff games without Porzingis or with a really injured Porzingis in this run. So they're capable of winning without him, but you put him in the – he brings a whole nother dimension to this team. I just think just naturally things are going to be harder. Everybody's going to be taking – starting with the New York Knicks on October 22nd, everybody's going to be taking shots at him. Everybody's going to get the best shot from every team, right? That's just going to be the facts of how it is. New York and Philadelphia have ramped up. We don't know what to expect from a team like Miami, Jimmy Butler in a contract year. Hopefully for them, they can finally stay healthy because they've not stayed healthy for a long time. They've always had injury issues. You know, Milwaukee, does Giannis and Dame and them have a run in them with Doc? Like, there's a lot of competitors, but I think the Celtics are overall the best team. Now, I do think they're mature enough to not live off the championship, still sipping the championship champagne. I think eventually, I think they're probably preparing their minds now when Media Day being next Tuesday. Like, all right, well, as much as that's we love it and we're champions and we're going to get our rings, that's over. It's a new season. It's 24-25. And I think with guys like Jrue Holiday and Derek White and Al Horford and Tatum and Brown, you have enough maturity on that team for them to take this real serious because I think other teams are going to take it serious. Now, do you want to start out like, you know, we could talk about the 08-09 team that started out 27-2 before Garnett started having his knee issues. Now they were punching. Like they came out like Mike Tyson in 88. Like they was like knocking fools out. And then AG got hurt. And you know, they were never the same after that. So they could have that mentality, like, oh, you think we slipping? We gonna slip? You think you're gonna catch us slipping? And especially Tatum and Brown with their issues with Team USA. Tatum kind of now needing to reprove himself as a superstar in the league and a top five player. So they have a lot of motivation. And also remember their coach, Joe Mazzulla. He's been spending his summer coming up with different ways to motivate these guys. He is not going to coach the same way he did last year. He's going to come up with some new methods, some new tricks, some jiu-jitsu moves for him. He's going to come up with some new stuff to keep these guys motivated because, quite honestly, he understands, I think everybody understands that championship hangover is real. And you look last year at Denver and Denver's going to Denver didn't get out of the semifinal. You know, there's teams that there's going to be a team in the East that we probably ain't talking about much, whether it be Indiana or somebody like that, that's going to put it all together and be a threat. We talk about the Knicks. We can talk about the Sixers. You know, we don't know about the Pacers could come up on and sneak up on somebody. Miami, you know, we don't know. And then we don't know what the hell's happening in the West. We got Oklahoma City, but what about Dallas? They ramped up a little bit. Minnesota, there's team Denver. Are they going to make one last run? So this is everybody's back. Everybody's alive again. All the graves that were put down and all the tombstones. When the Celtics went through and beat them all and got to the finals, they're all back to life. And that's the biggest challenge. So I think that's going to be hard, obviously, without Porzingis for 3 months. I think the sign of Lonnie Walker Jr. Is tremendous. That dude's a bucket getter. He's not even 26 years old yet. You know, he's bounced around a little bit. I'm stunned that he was available. He was a guy that I thought the Celtics should jump on. They did. And I just think the one thing that this team did not have last year, and you could maybe say Peyton Pritchard a little bit, was a bucket getter off the bench. Like,
thank you.
As much as you want,
thank you.
Like Lonnie Walker to play good defense, you need a dude. Like I always said, they needed like a like not older Jamal Crawford. They needed like a Jamal Crawford type, a dude who could come in, 10 points in 8 minutes, and go right
microwave.
Back and just said, okay, I you know, like Tatum and Brown got rest. I came in and boosted the offense so that we still got the lead.
Yes. Finish it off.
And if you need me, if you need me in the fourth quarter to hit something down the stretch or be another offensive weapon, that's what I'll do too. Like, I think Walker's that guy. I seen him in Brooklyn last year. I know a couple of games against the Celtics. I mean, he was just putting down buckets, and that's what he's turned himself into. So I think he's going to be a help. The whole thing of him going to Maine, I don't think he'll even – I think the only time he's going to go to Maine is probably you want to get him a nice lobster or something. He's going to be in Boston, right? Yeah, I don't think he's going to Maine. I think he'll really help this team, and for them to bring everybody back and everybody's motivated and just seeing, you know, you come off – I think everybody now, everybody's getting back to Boston to go start working out a little bit probably over maybe this weekend. And, you know, the season starts early because, you know, they go play those preseason games in Denver. Abu Dhabi. So – to me, they ought to be ready, but I think they will be ready.
You mentioned the guy that I think is going to get them ready. I think the Celtics team, there's a chance there could be a championship hangover. The only reason why I don't believe it, you mentioned, is Joe Mazzulla. I think he's just that much of a psycho that he's going to find different ways, like you were saying, to really motivate this team, and he's not going to let up. I don't even know if he slept all summer. I think he knows that, you know, that there is the championship hangover is real. And, you know, he's already come out and said that we got to be the ones that are the hunters and such, you know, the cliche stuff, but we've seen Mazzulla for the past 2 years now. We can understand he's wired differently. So this transitions to my last Celtics question with you is, you guys have an interesting relationship. Yeah. From the outside looking in, is all you guys always going back and forth. You've obviously talked about the shooting so much threes, and just you're echoing fans as well, right? Echoing of what we've seen and the
voice of the voiceless.
But when I watch you guys go back and forth, it seems like a healthy relationship. Honestly, I never thought it was any malice what's your relationship, and how have you seen him grown in the past couple years?
Well, I've definitely seen growth. The first year was rough on him because not only was he coaching his first NBA team, he was at the back of the bench when he first got there with Brad Stevens, and now he comes and is the head coach. You know, he's coaching with guys who were on Ime Udoka's staff who are trying to find jobs for next year because Ime gets suspended. I'm sure Damon Stoudemire eventually leaves for Georgia Tech. So you got these group of guys who all came in with Ime, except Tony Dobbins, who stayed, really good coach. And those guys, as much as they want, you know, they're signed with the Celtics, I'm sure Ime's telling those guys, hey, when I get my next job, you know, you got a job with me. So guys are trying to figure out where they're going to move their families. So I just think the focus of that staff wasn't complete. It was impossible for them to be completely locked in because Ime's interviewing for Brooklyn, then he interviews for Houston, right? Like guys are, he's trying to figure out where they're going to work next year. So Mazzulla's on a staff that the guys don't know him well, and then he's got to try to make it work, and they tried to make it work, and they almost went to the finals. And I just think he heard a lot of flack from the Miami series, the game, pretty much game three, when they basically gave up, you know, and they just threw in the towel. And that was, you know, and Wick Grosbeck went in the locker room and just jumped them and called them losers and all that. And the second year, he made adjustments. He made adjustments on timeouts and substitution patterns. He was uncomfortable with his own skin because now he's got his good staff around him. He got Charles Lee, who's now since gone to Charlotte Hornets. He's still got Sam Cassell, Tony Dobbins. He's got guys around him that he's comfortable with that are in there for the long haul. Although Charles Lee, I think everybody knew, you know, because he had incentive. if I help this fool to the finals, I know I'm getting my, I'm getting hired. I'm getting me a job. So everybody knew that Charles Lee was probably a 1 year commitment there. And because he's been the finalist for a couple of jobs. So I think Joe just made adjustments. Joe is a sensitive guy. He's a very possessive guy. He's very strong in his convictions, and so am I. So, like, we go at it, and we have a healthy respect for each other. You know, there's times we talk. I don't always write the stuff we talk about. We have a good relationship. Are we going to disagree? Is it my job to ask the tough questions? Yes. You know, it's not my job to be a Celtics cheerleader, Celtics pom-poms, green teamer. It's not my job. It's my job when they lose to ask why y'all lost. When they win, ask what you guys do to win. If he's sensitive about some of the questions, that's not much I can do about that. I'm not doing anything in malice. I'm not trying to, you know, get under his skin or I don't go into a press conference, guys. Like, I'm gonna piss him off tonight. Like, I just want to see what happens. Like, that's, I'm too old for that. That's not me. I'm not trying to make clips or whatever. I'm just trying to ask what I think fans want to know about shooting the threes. You guys shoot too much threes when you guys have two of the best mid-range shooters in the league in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Should you guys attack the rim more? You know, I remember Eric Spoelstra said during the 23 Eastern Conference Finals, let them, like, shut down the inside. Let them shoot threes. That's all they can do. That was their strategy. So I looked at that and said, damn, like, teams are on to the three-point thing. Like, and if you look at the finals, they didn't shoot the three well against Dallas, and they still won in five games, right? Like, you know, they weren't killing from the three. They did all the other things. They defended. They scored at the rim. They got to the free throw line. They played dirty dog, Missoula ball, except for the threes, and they won that series handily. So it's not always about the three, although I believe in the three. People are like, you hate threes. I do not hate three-pointers. I do not hate three-point shots, okay? I love three-point shots. I just don't like 60 of them in a game. you don't have to shoot 80 of them. Like, I think that you can mix in a little bit of, you know, getting to the rim, get to the free throw line, mid-range, but you got some good mid-range shooters. So we have a good relationship. We talked, you know, and I said, like, we're not enemies. We don't argue. We don't, like, does he get pissy in the, yes, that's fine. I'm a big boy. I can handle it. Like, I'm not, it does not put me, oh, he cooks you tonight. He could, like, he hates you. Like, people on X are, no, he does not hate me. Joe, a man of faith, he don't hate me. Okay. Now, I don't hate Joe. I like Joe. I think he's a very good coach. I think they had him as 11th best coach. I would have ranked him higher. I voted him second this year in coach of the year, behind the OKC coach. So, you know, like to me, he's a very good coach. He's only going to get better, but it's my job to hold, like, obviously there were different people and different dispositions, but I held Brad Stevens accountable also. You know, Brad just didn't take it. He just took the questions differently. Right. I mean, it was plenty of times I asked, you know, Brad very, very difficult questions when they blew leads or didn't get the job done. So Joe just takes it a little differently. He's a little bit more emotional. He's an unusual guy. And I think he showed that during some of his interactions with other national reporters in the finals. He's a different guy. And everybody's looking at me, and I say, see, it ain't only me. It ain't only me. I ain't say nothing. He on one. Yep. Welcome to my world. But I have highly amount of respect for him. Great, good family.
Right, I can see that.
High amount of respect for Joe Mazzulla. Like, if anybody will never say I will ever disrespect Joe Mazzulla, right? No, never do that. Never. I have a high amount of respect. I would never disrespect him, or, you know, I might question some of his coaching decisions or something like that, which is natural as a reporter, but never would I disrespect. I think he's a highly, highly impressive guy, great coach, and he's only getting better.
Yeah, I think Joe has taken his fair share of heat from Boston fans, Boston media. But I mean, I always, as much as sometimes I've given him, you know, heat as well, he's a young coach. You know, Joe's what, like a year older than me. You know, he just got thrown into a tough situation. And, you know, obviously the sky's the limit for him, you know, whether it be in Boston or wherever else he goes to coach, whatever the case may be, the sky's the limit. He's so young. And obviously he showed his knowledge this past season and, you know, a lot more room to grow, you know, as he continues his coaching career. But, you know, like Marv said earlier, we don't want to keep you too long. You know, we've got a lot of gems from you. And
you heard what he said about 3 hours, Mike. He said, you can't keep
we're not hitting that time. No,
I'm messing with you, man.
But I mean, if there's one thing that we do here on Double M before we wrap up, we like to put our guests on the hot seat a little bit and ask some rapid fire questions. And, you know, whatever comes to mind, you just you just spit them out and let us know what you're thinking. So you ready, Marv? You got the questions ready to go?
Of course, bro.
All right, let's do this. Gary Washburn here on the Double M hot seat. You said, you know, you're a West Coast guy. You've been in Boston for a while. Obviously, you've been around the world, been around the country. If you could sit right now with your most favorite dinner in front of you, what would be on that plate?
Wow. Probably just like straight up soul food, fried chicken, mashed potatoes, greens, corn. Yeah, just straight up soul food.
Never nice can go salad. Wrong with that.
Yeah, nice salad. Have a little greenery, a little roughage. Yeah, like just straight up. Ribs, yeah, straight soul food. Like, you know,
love it.
My wife's Jamaican, so I learned to love Jamaican food. But she's like, oh, she'll just call all that Black American food. Yeah, the Black American, yeah, baby, I'm Black American food. Yep, that's exactly what I'm eating. So, yeah, that would probably a typical Black American meal.
Okay,
nice. Favorite player to cover of all the time? Players you've covered, all time.
Wow. Wow, that's a good question. Wow. I would say, like, I had a good relationship with Ray Allen. Ray's a total professional, a good guy. But there's a lot of guys I liked and a lot of coaches that I got to know in baseball was, you know, to see there was a whole coach named Elrod Hendricks. He passed away several years ago and he kind of took me under his wing. He was like the bullpen coach for the Baltimore Orioles. He played in the World Series. And that was the bond I was talking about. Like I was in my early 30s and he was probably 60 something at the time. And he just took me under his wing. I remember being in covering the Orioles and the Dodgers, and he introduced me to a Hall of Fame pitcher named Don Newcomb, who was, you know, 70-something at the time. And I just shook his hand. I was just, like, in awe. And that was just, to me, that just meant the world to me. And I still think about him a lot. I mean, he's passed away several years ago. But that was probably the most enjoyable relationship I've had in terms of just and that was a coach, you know. But, yeah, enjoyed, love covering Ray. Pierce was a little crazy. KG was KG. He referred to me. I don't know if can I curse in this thing?
Yeah, of course.
He referred to me as like I was never Gary. I was light skinned motherfucker.
covering KG.
Times of covering the Celtics until he retired, and he started calling me Gary. I was like, you funny KG, you funny Kevin. Like, you know, but there's been a lot of people that covered. That over the years that have been just great people. But yeah, I'd say just for professionalism and just having conversations, like Ray Allen was a good guy.
And you got Ray in Seattle and Boston.
Yeah, the two. I was able to cover him in both places. So we got to know each other pretty well.
All right. What do you think the greatest championship team is that you've ever witnessed in any sport?
Okay, the best team I ever feel like I ever saw in basketball was the 83 Sixers, the fo team. They swept the Lakers like, you know, I was a kid then, and I mean, they beat the brakes off the Lakers. Like they swept. They like, and they, you know, Andrew Toney, the Boston Strangler, Moses Malone,
Strangler, I've heard
Dr. J, Mo Cheeks, Mark Ivoroni, like Clement Johnson, like just. like that team was loaded, and it was like the Lakers had beaten them the year before. The Sixers signed Moses, and I remember he made $2 million. And I was like, what? That's crazy money. $2 million a year? What? And he lived up to that contract, and that was the greatest. And they only was together like it was like a flash in the pan or whatever, one-hit wonder group. 84, they lost in the first round. They were never the same after that. They couldn't get it back. They never made the finals again with Dr. J and all that. But that 83 Sixers team, you know, people like 86 Celtics, yeah. But the 80s, like, I just sat there and watched the Lakers just get completely dismantled. And I'd never, as a kid, have seen the Lakers get completely just dismantled. Like, that was like, that's still the greatest team for 1 year, not a dynasty. Talk about the Warriors, talk about the Heat and their back-to-back and all that.
Yeah.
The Spurs, you want to go on Spurs, and Spurs don't get a lot of as much respect as they deserve. But that 83 Sixers team, if you want to look that up, like they just annihilated. It was like, man, we ain't got a shot here.
And then that Lakers, was in the finals,
yeah, took them final, on the finals. Lakers coming off a championship, and they just got beat down, and then they lost to Boston the next year in Game 7. It was like, man, are we ever gonna win one again? As a Laker fan, but yeah, that 83 Sixers team, and I know that's before your time, but like, look that up, like just the numbers and just like that one team. But current, I'll give you like we can see a current example. Man,
it doesn't have to be basketball because I know you cover some baseball as well. Any sport, actually.
Yeah, that's it. I let me see here.
83, 86.
83, and then obviously like the Bulls teams, the Bulls, you know, the Bulls teams in the late 90s or whatever, they were just toying with teams. Like Phil Jackson wouldn't call a timeout. He would let his team. He kind of was – Joe Mazzulla did the same thing. I don't know if he got the same impact as Phil, but he would just let his teams play out of – ruts or whatever. Then Michael Jordan would come up, score 20 points in a row, whatever. Yeah. So some of those Bulls teams were amazing. Were amazing too.
It's funny. I never thought of it now, but I can see a little Phil Jackson and Joe Mazzulla, kind of quirky, quirky in that way. I could see that. My question for you is, what is Gary Washburn listening to currently? What's a favorite artist that's on repeat, a song, album?
If any of my friends and my wife would hear you ask this, they start laughing because I don't know nothing current, man. Like I listen to
It don't gotta be current.
I listen to like old school. Like I'm into Marvin Gaye, Isley Brothers, a group called The Main Ingredient, The Bards. Like I'm all in the 80s, man. Like I'm in a time warp musically. And I said, my wife want to go see Usher. Don't jump on me for that. I took her to see Usher at, you know, and I know
we
Usher.
Love, we love Usher on this side.
okay. You know. So a couple weeks ago, I went to go see Usher, and I know all the current artists. I don't know a lot of their songs and something. Like, I know Drake and all that, but I'm just kind of stuck in a time warp when it comes to musically. You know, it's just that's who I am. And that, you know, everybody knows me, knows that, like, yeah, Gary's not the dude to ask about current music. Oh, what's Nas's best album? What's Jay-Z's top 10 hits? Like, I couldn't name 10 Jay-Z songs. I can name, like, let me introduce myself. My name is, like, I know the song. But you ask me name of top 10, I'd be like, yeah, let me look this up here. I'd be Googling, like young reporters would do, because... Yeah, like, and I said this whole Kendrick Drake thing, man, it's funny, but it's sad and all that. Like, two 38-year-old rappers beefing, like, this ain't, you know, like that, it's kind of funny to me. But yeah, that's musically, I'm like in a time warp. Like, I'll listen to some 90s, I'll listen to stuff. My wife's got me listening to certain reggae songs or whatever, but yeah, I am definitely an old schooler.
Got you.
Okay. definitely got to ask you this because you've been covering basketball so long and you've seen players up close and personal. And this is a debate that's going to continue for years and years to come. LeBron James, Michael Jordan.
Jordan. Okay. Jordan.
Not even a question for you. No debate. You're not even listening debate. To any
like, no, if you say LeBron, I'm not going to be like, you crazy. No. I'm not going to say that. LeBron's made a debate because of longevity. But okay, Jordan, I'll just say this. And I don't know if y'all were young and saw like older Jordan with the Bulls. With
Wizards last Jordan?
Wizards Jordan or even late Bulls like 98 Jordan. Okay. 98, y'all watched
yep, last 98, game. Yep.
Okay. I'll say this about Jordan. Jordan is just, he got that uh-oh factor. When he had the ball, he was like, and it was your team he was playing, he was like, oh, hell no. He about to do something I ain't never seen before. Like, uh-oh. Like, Jordan made you nervous. Yeah. I don't know if LeBron makes you nervous. Like, LeBron can.
I've heard players say that.
Yeah, Jordan, that's a difference. That's a difference. Jordan made your ass nervous. Like, you couldn't sleep on him. Like, Jordan was going, like, Jordan about do something I never seen before. Or he does this, you know, or he spin. Or, like, it was just like, you know, he don't shoot threes well. Oh, three from Jordan. Good. You're like, oh, my God. Like, that was Jordan. Like, Jordan made you feel, it was sort of like Patrick Mahomes now. 2-minute drive, you're like, yeah. Or Brady in his prime, right? 2 minutes, like, man, he's about.
Yeah, you knew you're done for.
Yeah, he about to win this. Like, it's no, like, that was Jordan. And that's the thing, that's the intangible. LeBron got better numbers, played longer, physical specimen. But Jordan had that, like, oh, hell nah. Like,
killer.
He about to get us. He don't lose. Yeah. 6-0 in chance. He don't lose. He got beat up when he got his team. Like, you was just like, oh man. Like, you know, that's the difference. That's the only thing I can say. Watching Jordan, he was just like, oh, especially you playing against your team. He was like, oh, here this dude go. Like, don't let, like, get enough lead or he can't win you to get, like, if he be off all night, you know, 2 for 20, last 4 minutes, like, oh, here is dude go. LeBron, I'd say I give him the ultimate credit. He has made this a debate. 10 years ago, you'd have laughed. Mm-hmm. Now he's made a debate. And I can understand how the younger generation looks at him. And because all of his accomplishments, gold medals, championships, getting to the championship, dragging teams that weren't good, like, you give him all that. He's more like Magic Johnson than he is Michael Jordan because of his passing ability, his basketball IQ. Like, I would not laugh at somebody thinking LeBron's a better player. But if you ask me, watching, it was like that, like, the difference is the killer factor and that Jordan never lost. Like, Jordan, he was just like, oh, man. Like, here, you know, like, here it is. And then it was something you had never seen before. Mm. Like, just dunking on somebody, spinning the air. Oh, let me just flip it up on my left hand. You're like.
He made it look beautiful. He just made the game of basketball look beautiful.
You know, yeah. Being the whole culture thing. I mean, God. Like, I saw a picture of, like, him with the Wizards and, like, yesterday. And he had, like, the J's on, the third generation.
People sleep on Wizards Jordan, man. Yeah, Wizards Jordan was still nice.
He was still – he had 55 in one game. He was 40. Yep.
On one leg.
Yes, one knee. He had bad – like, but it was, like, a picture of him in 01. So, I'm like, this is, like, before – this is a whole two generations ago. And he just looks so damn cool, even though – because, you know, you look at the – old Magic and you're like, oh, the Bird, the shorty shorts, oh man, how them dudes get around the floor? They says, oh, they look whack. Oh my God, how they even run in them shorts? But you look at Jordan, you're like, I can see that dude now. Like, you don't look
made at him everything be, look cool.
Yeah, you don't look at him and be like, damn, how did he get those shorts on? Or those shoes are look old. Like, you look, he can walk on the floor now. You'd be like, oh, okay, he could walk on the floor 2024, 25, and you would be like, man, that's a little cool as shit. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that's just the cultural thing. He changed the culture of the league. Iverson kind of helped change it to a certain level. But, like, when I covered the league, Jordan wore suits to every game. You look at the interviews, mm-hmm. everything was a suit.
Yep.
Every other player wore suits. he set the tone for the league. Like, if you look at the shoots, you know, look at the, I mean, Last Dance was real, should be, I'm hoping it was real educational for a lot of young basketball fans, because that's how everybody looked. Everybody came into the league, was like, yeah, your teammates was taking, you weren't going snopping for sneaks or nothing. You was going to the suit store and buying like 5 brand new suits because everybody had to look like Jordan. And then he got the league, and then Iverson came, and everything kind of changed. But, you know, AI, much respect to him. He's a cultural icon himself. But just, yeah, like, I got to still give it to MJ.
Okay. Say less.
Mike, I'm gonna pass it off to you for the I know your main question.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm gonna let you handle that before we wrap it up.
All right, final question before we wrap up here, Gary. If you could have a dinner for 5, and you can invite any 5 people in history, dead or alive, famous, not famous, whoever you want at that dinner table with you, you're handing out 5 invitations. Who are they going to?
All right. Ali, Muhammad Ali, okay. Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. Wow. I guess somebody younger. I'd say Michael Jackson.
Ooh, I like that one. That's my dad.
And probably.
That's a solid table.
Yeah.
That's a wild table, bro. That's a loud table.
Man, let me think of the 5th one. I probably would say Pac, just for the youth, just for like his reaction and how he would discuss and talk issues with X and Ali, like just for that youthful vigor, like not deep, like Death Row Pac where everything was West Side, he was tripping, but just like younger Pac when he was still, I don't know, digital underground Pac, but more like 93, 94. Yeah, 93, 94 Pac, like before everything got crazy. I would say that.
That's a solid 5. Okay.
I'm trying to imagine that table right now. What? Jeez, man. You wouldn't say a word. You just sit there.
No, listen, man.
Gary Washburn. This has been, I can't even put words to the gems and knowledge and everything you dropped. Like, for young up-and-coming journalists and writers who, you know, going through school and trying to write for their school newspaper, this is the podcast they need to listen to, because the knowledge and information you put out there,
right,
you know, from your own personal story and your journey, you know, everybody should hear this if they have the same aspirations as you. A guy who really, you know, had a goal from early on, from young age, and just went after it and, you know, grinded his way and found his way, and you've reached much success today. And like I said, you're somebody that myself, Marv, we follow, we listen to, we read, and it's just amazing to see, and it's just been such an honor and pleasure to have you on this podcast with us. So I want to say thank you, give you your flowers for sure, because you continue to do amazing work, and yeah, it's just
you're not done yet. So much more years to go to continue to inspire, and we're following you along the journey. One last question. You've been a part of Double M now. You're part of the Double M family. Moving forward, who would you like to see us chop it up with on another episode of Double M?
Wow, let me see here. What I like to see, let me think. Y'all should get Cedric Maxwell. If y'all got Cedric Maxwell,
we had Cedric Maxwell. That was probably one of our favorite.
Yeah, episodes. He's off the
we
chain.
Didn't talk. We didn't talk basketball at all. It was really.
If y'all ever get Jalen, I think that'd be great, man.
I would love to have Jalen Brown on the platform.
Yeah,
that'd be cool.
Yeah,
I would say that.
I know that might be difficult. But yeah, I'm trying to think. Even get Joe Mazzulla, if you get Joe. Joe, I know, does other podcasts. So, I think Joe would be great too.
Okay.
Word. Okay. That'd be really cool, man.
We appreciate Gary. Yep. Yeah. It's been an honor and privilege just to have you on, and want to say thank you again. Look forward to maybe you having on with us again sometime.
Yeah.
And whatnot, but thank you again for your time. This has been Double M Live for myself, Mike, got Marv over here, Gary, our special guest. Thanks for tuning in. As we always say, it's Double M to the moon.